With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn on what you want, like trying out that new workout class, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like a foam roller for your sore muscles. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
I'm Annie Apple, and I'm here to invite you to come and listen to my new podcast series, Raising a Pro. It's the most intimate sports-related conversations you will hear. Each week, we explore the journeys of some of your favorite NFL players through the eyes of those that know them best. From Joe Burrow, DeAndre Hopkins, Myles Garrett, Ezekiel Elliott, Nick and Joey Bosa, just to name a few. With exclusive insights and information, we leave no stone unturned. Subscribe now to Raising a Pro on your favorite podcast app.
HD Smartcast.
You're listening to a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Welcome to A View from the Stands, a podcast series in which we discuss the new normal in the world of sports. I'm Aditya Iyer, and with me is the national sports editor of HD, Rudranil Sengupta.
Today's episode is all about Rafa Nadal, who, of course, now has 20 Grand Slams, equaling Roger Federer's mark over what was an incredible Sunday for him. Somehow, and I can only speak for myself here, the number 20 loses some of its sheen when compared to the number 13, which is, of course, the number of French Opens that Rafa now has. Then there's that other mind-blowing number that Rafa achieved in Paris, which is 100 wins at Roland Garros in 102 matches. We have a lot to unpack here today, as you probably guessed. So to start finding some of the perspective, let's turn to my co-host to get things underway. I assume you also enjoyed that final, Rudra.
Oh, incredible. I loved it. I like sports to be contested, fought hard. I like things to go down to the wire. But sometimes I make an exception, and this was one of them. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's not because Novak Djokovic was on the other end. It was just because it was Nadal at Roland Garros, Nadal playing yet another French Open final, his, 13th final. And I was like, just let's do this. Let's completely steamroll over the opponent and win, which is what he did. And it's such a joy to watch him. It was incredible. Not a single game. How does that happen against the world number one? I mean, only Nadal can do this, and it's only in Paris that he can do things like this. It's incredible. Absolutely. Who are the two people he's lost to?
Oh, okay, yeah. So he's lost to Robin Söderling in the fourth round of the 2009 French Open. Those are the toe blisters that he was really suffering with.
Right.
And so that he couldn't really, you knew he was in trouble and he wasn't making up any excuses because he didn't go to Wimbledon after that either, and to defend a title that he had won in 2008. The other one, and this is the really impressive one, right? In 2015, Djokovic beat Nadal in straight sets in the quarterfinals. But Djokovic didn't go on to win the French that year. He won the first set in the final against Stan Wawrinka. And the Stanimal just showed up and beat him in four. The year that Djokovic won, Nadal actually was unbeaten. He pulled out after the first two rounds because of a wrist that was really bad. And, the coolest, cutest Nadal way, he told the press that, "My wrist is not broken, but if I play anymore, it will be broken." No, so that's what he said and pulled out. Yeah. I mean, there are very few sports people that I respect and admire and love more than Nadal. But I'm not saying this to kind of put him above or below Roger and Nole. I equally admire and respect them. But I can also very easily, appreciate each one of their, momentous wins, like Sunday was for Rafa, very easily. Because, you must understand that Novak Djokovic did the very same thing to Nadal at the 2019 Aussie Open final. I think in the second set, Nadal had 1 point on his serve. That's it.
Right.
So it was kind of a revenge match that way. But yeah, we've seen them destroy each other on their favored surfaces. And Nadal's done this historically, right? Like in 2008, in the French final, I think when he gave Federer all of four games, including a bagel in the third set. Man, yeah, like you said so rightly that in Paris, when one of these guys manages to dominate over each other, it often happens in Paris and that person who's dominating is Nadal.
I mean, and how lucky are we that we get to watch tennis in the era of Djokovic, Federer and Nadal? I mean, you know, I pinch myself. And maybe, I don't know, I mean, I was thinking about it and I had this shocking thought that maybe I'm some kind of a closet Nils and Boone kind of guy. Don't laugh because, you know, I mean, Federer is great, Djokovic is great, but there's something about Nadal and I was, what is that something? And it seems to me that it's his, it's, I mean, now he doesn't have it anymore, but those long wavy locks of hair, that kind of southern Spanish tan, you know, those rippling biceps and that, like, you know, charming, sweet smile. Yeah. All in all, that stuff just, like, you know, it bowled me over and I have always been a Nadal fan. I root for Nadal no matter what surface he plays on. And here's the thing, right? Of course, clay is a surface. And,
of course.
But, and a lot of people say that, okay, he's not really meant for hard courts. But what happens at the US Open? I mean, you know, he's won that four times. And in last year, against Danny Medvedev, that incredibly thrilling five-setter, which I don't know, went to over 4 hours or something. And it was like, you know, McEnroe playing ball. It was an insane match. And he pulled out everything that you can imagine from a tennis level at his level doing. I mean, all those down the line forehands, incredibly hard top spins, those insane angled shots, and he volleyed from the net incessant. The US Open court is something he likes as well.
Yeah, so I'll tell you what. So Nadal's critics, right, and there are many of them around, often begin with the fact that the North American leg of the calendar, which usually happens after Wimbledon. I mean, I know everything was kind of topsy-turvy this year. We're not talking about a coronavirus here. But generally in tennis, when they go across the Atlantic or the pond, as they call it, to North America, and they start off with the Rogers Cup in Canada and then come down to Cincinnati and eventually finish off in New York. Now, these courts once used to be terribly fast, like very, very slick, very fast. Used to suit the guys who used to, you know, ideally do well in Wimbledon before going there. And I'm talking about the 90s after, you know, there were four different surfaces for the four different Grand Slams, right? Like the slower hard court in the Aussie Open and the faster one in America. I'm not even talking about the time when it was grass in America, which was the 70s, right? So I'm very much talking about the 90s and the early 2000s, even after Federer started winning, actually. But the Nadal critics will be the first ones to point out to you that the courts in New York especially started getting really slow. The balls started getting heavier and you know about string technology, right? Like where with topspin and the kind of like guts that you have on a racket now, you can whack it from wherever you want. Like Rafa hits it from the crowd, right? And it somehow still manages to fall in. Now, all that has hurt the faster player, the guy who likes playing on a slick surf. So it shows because, see, Federer till 2009 was unstoppable in the US Open when it was really, really fast, right? He won five back-to-back. He was on his way to win his sixth when Del Potro beat him. And that's it. He's never won again. From 2010, like passing a beautiful baton over, Nadal has won four US Opens in a decade. So it just tells you how much that court has slowed down. Yes, yes, do discredit the surface, but please credit Nadal as well, man. I mean, it's not easy to pull off what he's doing with his body, his style of play, his very, like, you know, incredible techniques to adapt to a situation and to a surface. Please give him the credit for doing stuff like that. And also the Aussie Open, which is also a hard court Grand Slam. He has lost four finals in a row there now, just in the last decade. There was that incredible six-hour match to Djokovic, which again, like where he was very unfortunate to lose right at the very end and after having the breakup. When a first-timer in Stan Wawrinka showed up in 2014, Nadal managed to get injured. He actually cried in that final. If I don't know if too many people remember this. He was down two sets. He started weeping. People thought he's going to pull out. But Rafa never does that. Managed to win the third and lose in four. And he was also a breakup against Federer in the 2017 final, in the fifth, and still managed to lose. So, you know, he could have had like some 24, 25 by now.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's not a one-court guy.
No,
I mean,
he's not.
Yes, of course, he's not won as many. You know, he's only won one Australian Open. But, like, imagine reaching the finals at that many times and at the fights that he's put up. And here's the thing about injuries and his body that you mentioned. But in 2014, or I think he had a series of injuries. And we all thought that end of Nadal, because his game was so dependent on him, on his explosive, you know, fast twitch muscles, you know, his ripped, you're right, he was the sprinter. He could jump and get anywhere, and you know, that kind of move like a flea kind of thing that he has. So when he started having those series of injuries, that was the line of thinking, right? That, you know, that's what happens to an athlete who's so dependent on his fast twitch muscles and moving so explosively, is that you end up starting to get injured, and then that's the end of your career. But he's turned that around completely, which is just a delight. And, you know, his court game hasn't really changed. He's still chasing everything down. Yeah. But there's something about the way he does it that's changed. I don't know exactly what. And I wish there was, you know, there's a story I could read or some research I can read, because he's surely changed the way he trains his body itself. And you can see that in the way he looks right now. He's less ripped. He's less defined in that muscular way. And he's starting to look a little bit more like, say, Federer looks, which is, it's not apparent, but it's all steel. It's all like functional, efficient muscle under the skin. And it's helping him. He's been quite beautifully injury-free for the last couple of years, even though, you know, he's as explosive as ever and he's running as much as ever.
Yeah, I mean, listen, that's possibly the most crucial point when it's come to Nadal in his 30s, right? The one that you just raised, because injury management has been really, really important and crucial to his tennis. A lot of times people wrote him off saying, like, you know, that's it. I don't think he's going to come back anymore. You know, the way that the explosive tennis player kind of like knew that he had a shelf life of 5-6 years and it's time to like collect as many trophies as possible. Like, you know, the Söderlings of the world. And to some extent, even the Roddick, where his game was so physical, right? Like, you knew that after, you know, by his early 30s, there's a great chance that he's not really going to be relevant
in the second
week of a Grand Slam anymore. Yeah, that serve.
Just exactly. That serve. I mean, it took so much out of the body. Yeah.
Precisely. Yeah. With Nadal, he somehow changed all of that. Like, you know, a game that explosive and a good spot on his physicality too, because I think he's a little more balanced now, right? Like, you know, the rudder, which is his glutes, are almost as muscular as, you know, the upper torso, pecs and all of that, right? Like, yes, the arms are smaller now, but like he's more well-rounded. He doesn't have that carrot top body that he once had in, you know, when he was a teen and when he was 20. It's been really, really essential. But apart from that, Rafa never wanted to be just a clay courter, no? I mean, it's just one of those things that affected him. Even when he was a kid and people said, like, you know, you have now won 4 French Opens, 5 French Opens. Like, are you going to be so one-dimensional that, you know, you're going to end up winning 10, 12, 13 French Opens that he has now? No one thought it would be possible back then. But they were like, you know, is that all you're going to be about? And I think it hurt him. It hurt him constantly that, you know, he wasn't relevant anywhere else. Losing very early in the US Open, all, you know, non-contender in his first two Wimbledons. In the third one, he decided to sharpen his serve and he reached the final. And he realized that there is, if he puts his mind to something, there is really no one stopping him except Roger Federer at that point, because, you know, there was no Djokovic and there was no Andy Murray. But once those guys showed up and he had more people to compete with, because, you know, Rafa, I think at his core, is just an exceptionally like competitive person. If somebody tells him he can't do something, he will get it done. Or if he'll try. He'll, you know, die trying. But he will try, right? So when someone was there to challenge him on the hard court, see, because when Federer was a great hard court player, Rafa wasn't. There was no balance out there. He did whatever he could on grass, but like he was never really counted as a contender on hard courts. When there were people of his age, because both Murray and Djokovic are a year younger than him, almost exactly, right? So once they started pushing him on hard courts, he was like, "Hey, this is awesome, man. I mean, like, I have people who I can grow with and become amazing with." It just so happened that Djokovic became the greatest hard courter of all time. But, you know, Rafa's record against him isn't too bad, even on the hard courts.
True. And he adapts, right? I mean, it's what competitive people do. He adapts. He picks up things, like you said, that he sharpened his serve for the 2008 Wimbledon. Even last year, US Open, we saw him volleying so much more than before. Yeah. So he's
that's
got so much
that's
more
really
confidence.
Improved, volley.
Yeah.
Something he's really, really improved.
Yeah. I mean, you want to talk about that?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, like it was just very easy to see that, you know, when he was playing on clay earlier and he was as dominant as he is now, he's never really had a slump. He could sit back and completely dictate clay, right? But like once he started having to play on the faster hard courts, especially, and again, the North American leg, and see, there is no grass court season anymore. There's basically one tune-up. It's either in Queens or it's in Halle in Germany. And you get to choose one of the two because they happen simultaneously. Yeah. And then you have your two-week Wimbledon. That's it, right?
Right.
So before Rafa showed up, there was this tendency for, you know, players from Western Europe basically to focus on just the clay swing. Because you can kind of make up a lot of points right there and sustain your tennis career without ever having to step on, you know, some of the slicker surfaces. But Rafa, as we know, is a little more adventurous, right? Like, he just wanted to make it happen. So when he realized that he can't really sit at the back and dictate play, even though a lot of people accuse Wimbledon for having gotten slower, and you can see the patches of the back, right? It almost looks like you're playing on a mud surface by the end of the second week. He wanted to get better. You could see it in his very first Wimbledon final in 2006. He starts approaching the net. He's a little shaky out there against Federer. He's gotten through absolutely everybody else at this point, right? He's destroyed Agassi in the third round. But in the final, he can't get his head right against Federer. And you can see him learning on the job. You're playing the greatest grass courter of all time on his home surface, right? And you can see Rafa learning how to play grass court tennis in the final. He pulls off a set, but loses in four. The next year, he loses in five. The year after that, he wins in five. And that's all because of his... Yeah, I mean, that guy, really, like, you know, like you said, it's a blessing to tennis and most certainly to the fans. Now, you can see I'm gushing, so stop me and change the topic.
No, I'm not going to change the topic and I'm going to gush some as well and maybe we should end it here. The thing you raised in a story that you wrote recently about, you know, how dangerous Nadal has been at this late stage of his career, and you raised this thought which really resonated with me, which is that, you know, what there's for Nadal, there's like endless possibilities at the French Open, and what happens when he decides that, okay, this is finally, I mean, and we've spoken about how he's felt bad about being told that he's a one-court guy and he's gone out and, you know, improved himself and tried to, you know, get to the finals in every
great
slam
one.
And win it, right? But what happens when he completely accepts that, okay, Paris is his home and he decides that this is the only place I want to focus on winning? How many more French Opens can he win?
Okay, see, this is a great point, right? But there are two ways to look at this. One is, every player, every great player in the world that has ever been is usually more dominant on one surface than all the others. Djokovic, with 17 Grand Slams, has 8 at the Aussie. And if you take those 8 away, then he just has 11. Same with Federer. If you take his 8 away from Wimbledon, then he just has 12, right?
Yeah.
In Nadal's case, it's a little bit more obvious because he's won 13, something that no man has ever done before. I mean, Margaret Court won 11 Australian Opens back at a time when no one would visit Australia, one. And two, when she could wait in the final for the amateur to show up and she would just like beat that finalist and win the trophy again.
Right.
That's how easy it was to win 11, yet only one person did it. Nadal in this era of absolute glut, won 13 French Opens. Obviously, he's dominant on this surface, but just like the other two, as we mentioned, everyone has their preferred surfaces. And Federer has shown it in the later part of his career when he's picked and kind of chosen where he wants to play, right? Like he completely started avoiding the clay swing in 3 out of the last 4 years.
Exactly.
Because he knew that there's no point in wasting that energy when he can just focus on the ATP tournaments and the Grand Slams that he's, you know, most likely to win. He's bettering his chances. Rafa is going to start doing that at some point. Maybe when he's 38, maybe when he's 40, God knows, right? But he's going to start playing only the clay swing. And that almost guarantees him a French Open because the gap between him and the next best player, and let's suppose the next best player right now is Dominic Thiem and not Novak Djokovic.
Yeah, Thiem is 27. What happened to Thiem last year.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but see, Thiem's always been getting better, that little bit better against Rafa in every subsequent French Open match, right? So now we've had 2 semifinals and 2 finals, not counting this year, back to back for 4 years straight. From 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, they've met either in the semis or the final. And each step has, like, you know, just the way Rafa kept getting better against Federer on grass, Thiem has been getting better against Nadal on clay. But it's a little more dangerous because Thiem is a clay court player, right?
Right.
He's one of those guys who's learned to play on other surfaces as well. So Nadal can go on forever. And once he starts picking and choosing, he almost ensures that he's got, like, you know, another 5, 6, 7 French Opens, maybe. I think he's got 20 Frances in him, 20 Roland Garros. So
Wow. That would also put him, I think, beyond the reach of anyone else. I mean, we are basically predicting that Nadal will have the most Grand Slam wins of any player ever.
I'm actually not predicting that, Rudra. I really think Djokovic will have one more than Nadal ever does in his life.
Yeah.
By the time he retires. Yeah. Because Djokovic is that bloody good. But Nadal's... It's just the era, right? Like, people have been trying to predict this stuff since 2003 when it all started. It's just gotten bigger and crazier and more overwhelming. I think we should just leave it at that because predictions are the worst thing to do in this era. Could you have predicted a man winning 13 of the same Grand Slam?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, I think that's where we should be.
This was an episode of A View from the Stands. Do like and follow us on at HT Smartcast on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, or write to us on podcasts@hindustantimes.com. You can listen to more podcasts by logging on to htsmartcast.com.
This was a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.